You are listening to a sermon by Carl Friesen, recorded on Sunday, November 18, 2012, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
So as I said, I think several of you have requested that I share a little bit more about what my thesis is actually about, because I've obviously had conversations with several of you about it. And so that's what I want to do today. Unfortunately, I have a lot more to say than, first of all, probably any of you want to hear, or second of all, than you could handle for one morning. So I'm going to try my best to keep it succinct and brief and relevant as well. But if you recall, on Labor Day weekend, at the beginning of September, I gave a sermon here on the formative and dynamic nature of human beings, for those of you that were here. For those of you that were not, well, for both of you, I guess, I want to give a very brief refresher of that sermon because it very much ties into what I want to talk about today. So I argued that human beings are not, first and foremost, thinking things, but rather are fundamentally loving or desiring beings. And what I meant was this. The core of human essence, or of what humans are, of what constitutes human identity, is not centered in our heads, or in what we know, or in what we rationally think, but it is centered in our hearts. Every human being has these kinds of ultimate loves or ultimate desires that essentially drive them to act in certain ways. So one could say that each person has an unspoken or an implicit picture of what they think true human flourishing looks like, and they're aiming for or longing for that goal. Now, of course, this does not mean that rational thinking is not important. It simply means, it simply means that there's a substantial part of every person that operates at a non-cognitive or a precognitive level. In other words, there's a substantial part of who we are that is not actually controlled by deliberate conscious thought. We act out of what we often call our second nature. And what we mean when we say that is that there's some habit or some longing that's so deeply ingrained in us that we naturally act a certain way or respond a certain way. And this is essentially what I was referring to by ultimate loves. But I also argued that our ultimate loves are not static or unchanging. It's not as though we have some image of what human flourishing is that just always remains the same. No. Our ultimate loves or our longings, our second nature, if you want to call it that, are always being shaped by our practices or by what we do. And our practices are always born out of and reflect a certain picture of human flourishing. And when practices are then ingrained in us over time, they actually change us. They actually change our basic dispositions. They actually change the way that we view what human flourishing is, or what we are ultimately longing for. And if you recall, I used the example of a shopping mall to illustrate that culture is a charged set of practices. It's something that we do, and it's something that shapes and it forms us into certain kinds of people when we participate in it. So basically, my contention was that culture functions as a kind of liturgy. Or, in other words, by liturgy, I just mean a formative set of practices. That's what culture is, that ultimately shapes us when we participate in it. Now, obviously, no culture is monolithic or homogeneous. There's a variety of different and competing images of the good life that are being put forward all over the place, and we are shaped by the ones that we participate in. Now, I put all of this back into your minds because this is very much tied to what I want to talk about today, which is that human rights function as a kind of liturgy in our culture. So my argument is that the cultural practice of primarily utilizing human rights language and human rights frameworks for when we think about justice, has actually shaped us and formed us into thinking about persons and about human flourishing in a certain way. Now, I realize this may sound quite theoretical or abstract. It seems like it may not actually have a whole lot to do with our everyday lives. But I believe that it is an intensely practical discussion, because how we envision human flourishing, or how we envision ourselves in relationship to others, in relationship to God, and in relationship to the rest of creation, actually has a profound impact on how we live together and what we work for when we work for justice. And I don't think anyone would disagree with me when I say that the human rights language has been thoroughly incorporated into our contemporary political and social context. So one hears references to rights, very glibly often, in almost every serious conversation about justice. People are throwing out the language of rights. Especially since the unthinkable atrocities of World War II and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that followed, the language and conception of justice as rights appears to be so deeply ingrained into both the scholarly and popular parlance or language that if one disputes its validity, the validity of thinking of justice in terms of rights, then it is actually perceived as a challenge to the foundation of a free society or of human dignity. So if you challenge rights on the one hand, people think you're also challenging human dignity or human worth. Excuse me. So in some sense, we could say rights have become axiomatic in our culture. They're unquestioned and unquestionable from many people's perspective. If one wants to work for justice, the unquestioned assumption goes, then one must work for, or perhaps even fight for, human rights. Now, I'm not sure that a lot of people even know what they're actually referring to when they glibly refer to rights, but I assume that if you probe them long enough, and if they were thoughtful people, which you can't always assume, what they would essentially mean is that human beings have certain entitlements that are due them on account of their worth as individuals. So in other words, because each individual person has a certain worth, he or she deserves certain things, like perhaps life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. My argument is, though, that when we think of justice primarily in terms of individual rights, or in other words, if we think that individual rights are what justice should be based on, then we actually have an impoverished view of what persons are, because we view persons first and foremost as separate individuals with entitlements rather than persons in relationship. So let me repeat that. If we think that individual rights are what justice should be based on, then we have an impoverished view of what persons are, because we view persons first and foremost as separate individuals rather than persons in relationship. So let me offer a few very important clarifications here, especially for those of you that perhaps work with the legal system once in a while. First of all, I'm not arguing that we should refrain from using all rights language altogether, especially in our legal discourse. It's probably inevitable that we do so, because as citizens of a particular country, we will have certain legal rights that lawyers are there to protect. That's their job. They're basically, in many ways, holding the laws or the government, the bureaucratic structures, accountable to their own standards. I'm also not arguing that individuality and sociality are mutually exclusive. In other words, I'm not arguing that persons can't be, and in fact shouldn't be, both individuals and beings in relationship. I'm not trying to pull those two things apart. My argument is that how we fundamentally envision what a person is impacts how we do justice and how we relate to one another. And that's what I want to, that's where I want to come from. In other words, what I want to think about with you is, what is a proper starting point for justice? Are persons first and foremost individuals with entitlements, or are they rather beings in relationship? So let me begin by briefly telling the story of how we got here to the point where rites are such an important part of our culture, because it is quite new. The notion that persons are essentially individuals with rights began, for the most part, of course it was a big shift in movement, but began in the 17th century with thinkers like Thomas Hobbes and John Locke on the one hand, and also the later work of people like Jeremy Bentham, and even more so with John Stuart Mill. These are all very prominent philosophers in the Western tradition. But because these thinkers were so modern, in a sense, and therefore much of what they had to say will not seem that very strange to us, I think it will be valuable to look very briefly at the view of persons, or the view of justice, that they were opposing, that they were actually trying to work against. So the more ancient view that Hobbes, Locke, Mill, and others were opposing was that justice is a virtue that directs society toward a common good. So put another way, justice was about the pursuit of unity in a shared common good. That's what justice meant. So the role of an individual person then in that picture of justice was to cultivate the virtue of justice, or in other words, to cultivate their characters to become just people so that they could contribute to the common good. Now notice how drastically different that sounds than individual rights language. But in this ancient view, the common good was not seen as something that was in tension with the good of the individual person. Rather, the good of a properly oriented society was at the same time the good of its individual members. It's not as though the individuals had to just destroy themselves so the good could, or the common good could flourish, but it was supposed to be a both and. So in this view, the focus of justice was on the common good of the whole community from within a network of necessary relationships that were supposed to be oriented properly. So in other words, persons were understood as inherently relational beings, because a person is born into relationships. You can't be born as an individual, they would argue. You're born to somebody. You're born into a family. You're born to parents. You didn't come there on your own. So I know that there's a lot to process, perhaps, in a very short time. So let me sum up the ancient view this way. The ancient view was that persons are beings that are necessarily, or one could say naturally, in this whole network of relationships. And to do justice was to cultivate virtue, or to cultivate character, in such a way that one would by second nature act in a way that would benefit the whole common good. And so there's two things to notice about this. Like I said, first of all, persons are inherently relational. So one could not really make sense of who someone is, or who someone was, outside of this network of relationships. And second of all, persons were teleological. Or in other words, what I mean by that is it is considered that persons had some kind of a purpose or some kind of an end that was outside of themselves. So there's some kind of an objective standard, as it were, and people were expected to live up to that standard. If they didn't, they were considered unjust or whatever. So that's the ancient view, and for those of you that are familiar with philosophy or theology, will notice that this is the kind of way that people like Aristotle, Augustine, and Thomas Aquinas described justice. And then came people like Thomas Hobbes. And Hobbes deliberately argued against the ancient notion of personhood. So that very quick and perhaps complex picture that I just painted, he argued against that. Hobbes lived in the era when what we would today call science was just beginning to develop. So this was the age of Galileo and Francis Bacon and others. This was an age of incredible revolution in scientific knowledge. So to a great extent, there was an obsession with mathematics, with the scientific method, with rationality, and so on. And people did not view the world in quite as fragmented a way as we do today, or in such specialized eyes. And so one person would do what we consider natural science, high-level mathematics, philosophy, be an inventor, and so on. This was all one person would often do all those things. Of course, they didn't do all those things well often, but they still did all those things, and that was considered normal, unlike today. And so people had a much more unified picture of reality. So in line with the growing science of the day, Hobbes attempted to construct a completely comprehensive philosophy of reality, really, based solely on mechanistic science, based solely on rationality. He wanted to get rid of all this, what he considered meaningless speculation from the past. And he thought that mechanics and mathematics should be able to explain everything. And from his perspective, the reason that there was political conflict and unrest was that politics was not sufficiently scientific. He actually wanted to make politics into a science. So he tried to come up with a political theory that was purely scientific and rational. And he believed that one of the biggest mistakes of the past accounts of justice and of personhood was that they had assumed that persons are naturally social beings, or assumed that persons had some kind of a purpose outside of themselves. He wanted to oppose both of those things. So over against this view, Hobbes argued that human beings are fundamentally asocial, meaning that they're fundamentally not in relationship to other people, meaning that they are fundamentally individuals. And this was a fairly radical shift, to think of persons as individuals, first and foremost, as individuals. And then he argued that the only scientifically verifiable thing that we can say about these individuals is that they all are concerned with their own pleasure and their own preservation. In other words, the only way he could scientifically make sense of what a human person is was by viewing them as separate beings that all want to preserve their own life. So in some sense, in Hobbes' view, persons are just a bunch of separate machines. He actually uses the language of a machine. They're separate machines that are trying to perpetuate their own life. They're trying to keep their own life going as long as possible, and they have no fundamental purpose or relationship even with these other autonomous machines. Their relationships are just artificial. We have relationships, of course. We interact with people, but they're just artificial. They're secondary to this fundamental drive to stay alive. So Hobbes radically opposes the idea that there could be such a thing as a common good. In his mind, that simply doesn't make sense. What would a common good be? There are just a bunch of individual goods, each of us trying to preserve our own life. So people are basically, and in his mind, rightfully selfish, because that is how they're going to survive. So Hobbes based individual rights on these egoistic drives that individuals have. So the two fundamental human rights that Hobbes kind of lifts up and bases all of justice on, thinks that this is what society should be based on, these two rights, was the right to life, which was based on this natural drive to preserve life, that we all have to preserve our own life, and the right to liberty, which was based on the desire that we all have to be left alone, or not to be harmed, basically. So Hobbes shifts from viewing persons as beings that are in relationship, in this big network of relationship, this unifying common good. He shifts to viewing them first and foremost as individuals with entitlements, separate individuals with entitlements. But our modern understanding of human rights has also been heavily influenced by thinkers like Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, especially John Stuart Mill. And unfortunately, I really don't have time to unpack Mill's views, except to say that Mill agreed with Hobbes that human beings are fundamentally non-teleological, meaning that they have no purpose outside of themselves. They have no real greater end or there's no kind of standard that humans are expected to live up to. They're fundamentally individuals rather than persons in relationship. He agreed with that as well. And to an extent, he also agreed that humans naturally seek pleasure over pain. And then Mill went and he emphasized individual freedom to a whole new degree. So for those of you that have read his book entitled On Liberty, that's essentially his argument, is that he considers individual freedom basically the greatest good. Now, he does nuance it, so I realize I'm oversimplifying for sure, but that is very much important to Mill's view of justice. And so Mill famously quipped in On Liberty, he famously quipped that as long as an action does not harm someone else, a person should be free to do as they please, even if that action is clearly destructive to the person that's doing the action. Now, to us, that, again, sounds very normal, because I think that view of freedom, that Millian view of freedom, of being free from interference from other people, has become one of the most important values in our society. And that logic gets played out all the time if you read articles in the newspaper or watch television or whatever. So basically, as a rights-based view of justice and of personhood was adapted into cultures in many parts of the world, especially in North America, where essentially they started from that basic premise, this view of Hobbes and Mill of human persons became very prominent in those cultures. So the focus of justice shifted from a robust sense of the common good in this more ancient view to dividing up society's resources and then giving them to individuals so that they can each do with them as they then see fit, because it's their own private property. And so the point is this: there's an implicit understanding of personhood in rights theories, and when we engage in the practice of using rights language, then we're actually formed into viewing persons that way as well. And so our image of what human flourishing is actually changes. What we long for or what we aim for is actually changed. So let me briefly point out three problems with the rights way of viewing persons, and then begin to paint a picture for an alternative and what I think is a more holistic and biblical view of what persons are. And of course, that last part could and probably should be a whole separate sermon, but it'll have to suffice for today. So the first problem that I want to point out with the rights view of human persons is that rights theories insist that persons are first and foremost separate individuals, and this leads to a fragmentary view of justice. So rights insist that persons are separate individuals that, and instead of primarily beings that are in relationship, and this leads to a fragmentary view of justice. So in a rights-based culture, the individual and her entitlements are the ultimate and the irreducible reality, one could say. The individual is an individual prior to any form of sociality. Prior to any relationships, a person is an individual. And society exists for the sake of giving individuals rights. That's what society is for, so that each individual then has the freedom and the capacity to go about doing their own thing, doing whatever they want. Feminist theorist Carol Gilligan argues that the shift toward rights is essentially a shift toward defining the human person as a separate individual rather than a person that is in relationship to others. So there's not only a lack of a robust sense of a common good, but there's also no necessary or inherent connection between persons. This becomes evident in the just individualistic and legalistic terms through which relationships are often portrayed. So for example, if one looks at marriage through the lens of rights, then the focus is on each particular individual's entitlements to certain goods, or in other words, their rights, rather than mutual love and care for one another. So the focus is on the two separate individuals rather than the connection between them. In other words, the focus is on protecting individuals from others, since rights are a primary good and relationships are not necessarily, rather than fostering healthy relationships. So to be clear, I don't want to make it sound like there's some kind of a tension between protecting individuals on the one hand and fostering healthy relationships on the other. The problem is that when one looks at persons or at justice primarily through the lens of rights, then one begins by seeing separate individuals and then honoring each of those separate individuals, and honoring each of those separate individuals' rights is the most important good. In an important sense, this is a fragmented view of justice and persons because connection and attachment or relationship are not actually intrinsic parts of being a person. They may be occurring, but they're secondary to rights. The second problem with this view of persons is that rights cannot provide a grounding for a common good. Rights cannot provide a grounding for a common good, meaning that when one sees justice as rights, one cannot even really talk about anything other than individual private goods, because there are simply no categories whereby to do so. So, theologian and geographer Janelle Curry points out that because rights discourse is based only on individuality and entitlement, there's a fragmentation of creation and of nature as well. Because in order to be fair or just, in a rights view, everything is divided into pieces and then allocated to the plurality of separate and conflicting individuals. So, for example, because there's no real common good, and the individual and her entitlements are the most basic unit of reality, or the most basic good, forests, fishing plots, lakes, whatever, all of nature is actually split into fragmented pieces so that it can be distributed to all these different groups or individuals. In an important sense, justice is about separating and building hedges of protection around individuals and their rights, as well as separating and building hedges of protection around these fragmented pieces of nature all over the place. And while protecting individuals is certainly a worthwhile endeavor, absolutely, there's a notable absence of a greater purpose for nature from within a context of cooperative and unifying relationships that actually bind people together or bind people to nature or hold nature together. Any of those things can't really be talked about in a rights view. So rights can't really provide a perspective that goes beyond the individual and therefore cannot provide the framework or the category that is necessary for a unifying common good. And finally, the third problem is that the alleged absoluteness of rights results in polarization rather than mutuality. So the alleged, because rights are apparently absolute, you either have a right or you don't, there's no in between, this kind of view of justice or of goods results in polarization. Because the simplistic language of rights is the language of no compromise, it's an all or nothing ordeal. Again, you either have it or you don't. But when justice is viewed in these kind of stark and polarizing and absolute terms, then issues become increasingly difficult to resolve, because there's no consideration of the greater consequences of granting specific rights, leaving little or even no room for compromise or for mutual edification or, again, for rallying around a common good. So, for another example, once you see the abortion debate as a conflict of individual rights, so the rights of the mother on the one hand versus the rights of the fetus on the other, there are few, if any, stopping points between the unlimited immunity of the one or the untrammeled freedom of the other. So you basically end up having two special interest groups that all line up. There's a very clear line down the middle. You're either pro-life or pro-choice, and then you hurl rocks at each other. But there's no real way you can actually talk about that issue in proper terms. Like, what does this issue actually mean? Or what does this issue do for our society? So injustice issues are framed in the language of absolute individual entitlements. It usually ends up polarizing these kinds of rival interest groups and then really forcing people into these incredibly unbalanced and partisan social views. And perhaps it's even easier to be a critic from north of the border, but it seems sometimes that's even more the case in the United States when election time comes. And you see this just incredible polarization going on. And there's no sense of, let's have a conversation. Let's talk about what we can together do. Even though we have fundamentally different outlooks, let's think about what we can do together and cooperate with one another. That is just completely outside the picture. So let's bring this all back to around to my sermon and my brief opening today. My sermon from a few months ago, sorry, and my brief opening today. And what I want to highlight is that when we engage in the practice of using rights language or a rights framework to think about justice, then our image of what human flourishing is, or the language I used earlier, our ultimate loves, are actually formed into the image of human flourishing that underlies individual rights. And our precognitive loves are shaped to reflect the highly problematic image of persons that is in rights. So in other words, when we wrestle through different ways of framing justice, it's not just a matter of determining which understanding of justice is the most logical, which is obviously important, but that's not the only factor we can think about, or even which understanding of justice will give us the most goods or the most freedoms, which is also a good thing to think about, but it's also not the only thing we need to think about. When we wrestle through an account of justice, when we wrestle through what we think justice is, we need to ask ourselves, how is this account of justice shaping us? What kind of people or communities are being formed with this view of justice? So to reiterate what I said in the beginning, the point is that the image of personhood, or of what persons essentially are, that underlies a rights-based understanding of justice is based on an imbalanced and flawed view of persons, and therefore will also cultivate us to think of ourselves and our relationship to others and our relationship to God and our relationship to creation in a flawed way. Because we actually begin to envision justice or human flourishing in a distorted lens. We start to aim toward the wrong goal. And again, I'm talking about ultimate loves here. I'm talking about precognitive loves that we have, or a drive that we have. So in closing, while I certainly do not want to downplay the positive things that rights frameworks have accomplished, I think it's important that we recognize how the use of rights frameworks have shaped us. If a rights-based perspective of justice is incapable of resisting the fragmenting individualism of our culture, then I think we must rely on a different path. We must rely on a different image of what justice is. And this is not to hearken back to some utopian vision from the past or to glorify some golden age as our model, because every age has had its fair share of injustice. But rather, it is a radically different starting point, I think, than rights can provide us. So speaking now from a distinctly Christian perspective, our visions of justice must be born out of formative practices that reflect a more holistic and more biblical perspective of justice. So a vision of justice that is based on mutuality, on radical dependency, on ceaseless generosity, on inordinate hospitality, and sacrifice and suffering rooted in the life of Christ. In other words, we need a truly extraordinary politics. In other words, our vision of justice must begin with a basic mutuality, friendship, and generosity rather than entitlement. Of course, this doesn't mean we have no entitlements, but it means that those entitlements only make sense within this bigger context of mutuality, of friendship, of generosity, and of dependency upon one another. I think the practice of hospitality is one example of a Christian practice that can bring about such an extraordinary politics. So think here specifically of the passages in Matthew chapter 25 and 2 Corinthians 5 that were read earlier. And hospitality takes a radically different approach to persons than rights. Hospitality begins with the recognition that life is a gift to be shared rather than an entitlement to be protected. It is a formative practice, one could call it a liturgy, that acknowledges our dependence on one another. And as such, it is a practice opposed to the rights emphasis on individual autonomy, because it recognizes and responds to the dependency and the vulnerability that we all share. And although hospitality begins by meeting the most dire human needs, again, think of Matthew chapter 25, it also extends itself in friendship and welcome of the other. And through friendship with the other, the practice of hospitality has a transformative effect on both host and guest. As doors of welcome are opened, the table of one's labor is generously shared, and stories are exchanged. Hospitality values persons and friendship between persons over individual claims to goods. The focus, in other words, is on generosity of shared goods rather than the fragmentation of individual goods. Now, needless to say, there's always the potential for the generous and the vulnerable to be exploited. And although seeking personal security and protection may certainly be necessary at times, I don't want to undermine that either, this does not mean that we have to resort back to focusing only on individual rights. We should not rely principally or primarily on rights language, not because it's never done anyone any good, but because it forms us or it shapes us into seeing individuality, autonomy, and entitlement as the true source of human flourishing. By contrast, an extraordinary politics opposes this emphasis on individuality by embodying practices that actually mirror the radical dependency and the vulnerability that we share with all of creation.